Please be seated. All right, our only case on the 10:30 docket, McCray v. State. If Ms. Bezek will introduce counsel, please.
May it please the court, Mr. Ronald Couch will argue for appellant. Mr. David Crowell will argue for the state.
All right, Mr. Couch.
Good morning. I represent the appellant, Danny McCray, and his appeal of his conviction of aggravated assault on a public servant and on a second person. Since the state's brief was most lengthy in relation to the issue of multiple attacker request for instruction by the trial attorney, I'll talk about that first. I think the first line of the state's brief kind of sets a tone for what happened that night, wherein it says the important facts of this case took place over a 50-second period at a 7-Eleven parking lot. In the factual section, I think it's clear that this incident took place at night. It was at the intersection of Beach Street and Lancaster in Fort Worth. There were many people there. Apparently, there was a lot of traffic, people coming and going in the store, people parking, people leaving, people pumping gas, and people inside the store. I think there was also testimony that there were people in line at the cash register, so I think it was a busy store that night. The issue of the multiple assailant request by the defense, I think, was reasonable, because this all happened very fast. Within that 50-second period, Mr. Toledo approached McCray, Officer Mills approached McCray, and then Officer Hull. I think this all took place in a matter of seconds, because people who testified at the trial indicated they could see some of it. They didn't really understand what was going on because it was very confusing. And I think that also could be implied that the appellant didn't have an appreciation of what happened, because it happened so fast. Now, the other couple of facts are the issue of the officers being in plain clothes. They didn't have uniforms. They didn't have weapons that were showing. Apparently, they didn't arrive in police cars. I think they were in undercover vehicles. So you then have a situation where an officer identifies himself over a matter of a split second by pulling out his badge. It was apparently on a chain saying police officer. And apparently that happened just a second or two, or maybe a half second, before the stabbing of Mr. Toledo, or shortly thereafter. It's a little unclear from the record whether or not...
How is he being attacked? I mean, there's not any question. I mean, even your brief, you know, pretty much says the appellant exited his vehicle, cursed at Toledo, and stabbed Toledo in the stomach with a small penknife, and then the officer whips out his thing. How's he being attacked at all until he runs away and gets shot?
My reading of the record was, like I said, it happened so fast it could be interpreted different ways, but McCray and Toledo approached each other in the parking lot, and that's when the stabbing occurred. And I think there was indication that Toledo made a move toward McCray, and at that point, the officer intervened.
According to Toledo,
he realized it was an officer and was satisfied, or could even comprehend that he was seeing a police officer there, is a question I have that I think raises the need for a multiple.
I guess what I'm asking is what actions that the officers took constituted an attack on him. I mean, raising up, you've just stabbed somebody and then somebody raises up their police badge, that doesn't constitute an attack
or a threat. There was testimony that McCray apparently had his hand up and the officer went toward him. That could be interpreted as an aggressive move by the appellant. Taking into consideration all the facts that happened that night, happened very quickly. Now, the state responds that they shouldn't have had, the court shouldn't have entertained a self-defense instruction in the first place, let alone a multiple attacker instruction. Our response would be that, well, the judge did the self-defense instruction, and therefore it should have been complete and accurate and adequate for the situation. And our allegation is that by failing to grant the multiple assailant instruction, there was error, and Mr. McCray should be entitled to a new trial. I'd like to move to the other issue. I think it's probably more important, which would be the Batson issue. As the court can see from the record, the following morning after the jury had been sworn in, apparently there was a realization that the juror that was supposed to be there wasn't there, and the court proceeded to grant a Batson challenge, although the state in their brief indicates that they think that was waived, but because it wasn't done prior to being sworn in. Nevertheless, again, we have a situation where the court went ahead and granted it. Same argument, I guess, is that if the court granted the Batson challenge, the court should have addressed the issues of the jurors that were raised by the defense, being jurors 10, 11, 17, 39, and 43. Trial counsel pointed out that those people also had similar concerns, as did the juror who was struck, but that was not addressed by the court. And I'm not sure. One of the things I was concerned about is the fact that after the jury is selected, the juror questionnaires are normally taken up and removed from the courtroom. So they came back the next day, I assume, but I don't know, that the jury questionnaires weren't there available for either side. So I don't know to what extent either side could have gone back and digested what was in the juror questionnaires in order to respond to the challenge. Nevertheless, I think the response relating to juror 10, 11, 17, 39, and 34 was didn't happen. And in the Moore case that's cited by the state, in which that was reversed because of one juror, Mr. Harris, I believe it was, the trial court concluded that should entitle the defendant to a new trial. We believe that because Judge Thomas did not address that issue, that the Batson the challenge should have been sustained, and the defendant granted a new trial. And in respect to juror 34, even if the state came up with a race-neutral reason for her, the judge didn't respond to the other challenge, and I think he should have done that. In respect to the last issue would be the sufficiency of the evidence. It's our position that the evidence was factually insufficient to conclude that the appellant was guilty of aggravated assault on a public servant. It's clear from some of the testimony that the bullet, apparently the first bullet that hit Mr. McCray, according to some of the medical testimony, was fired from his back through his chest, which meant that Mr. McCray was heading into the store when he was shot. That's consistent with the blood splatters on the front door of the store. So the issue at that point is whether McCray was shot by the officer while he was facing him, or was he shot by the officer when he was fleeing. I think the medical testimony by the doctors and the entry in some of the medical records that were offered into testimony show that there was a real doubt as to whether or not he was shot from the front or the back. And the other issue kind of relates back to the issue of whether or not there was sufficient factual evidence to show his assault against the police officer. The witness at the gas pump, I believe, said he saw part of it, but he couldn't really discern what was happening. And so for that reason, I think that would sustain or should sustain our claim that it's factually insufficient.
Why? Tell me why.
Actually, insufficient.
If there was aggravated assault on the police officer, what difference does it make if he shot while fleeing or shot while coming toward him?
Well, that would bring up the self-defense issue, I suppose, if he was...
But that's a different question.
Well,
if he came at the officer and stabbed him in the shoulder with a knife, mm-hmm. whether he gets shot after he turns around and runs away or whether he gets shot while he's in the act of doing it doesn't change the fact that he did it.
Well, I understand that argument, but our position is that all these questions should have led the jury to conclude that it was insufficient to support the conviction. Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Couch. Mr. Curl?
May it please the court, my name is David Curl, and I'm here representing the state. I just would like to talk about points of error 2 and 3 this afternoon, and unless there are any questions on point 1. With regard to point of error 2, appellant claims that the trial court should have sustained his Batson complaint with regard to veneer person number 34. The first thing I wanted to point out is that, the state didn't strike 2 or 3 African Americans, and they sat on the jury. And that supports the trial court's ultimate Batson determination. We discuss that in our brief at page 14. The second problem with appellant's Batson complaint is that, as I read the record, he says that they were sworn in the day before. I don't think they were sworn in the day before. They came back the next day. The judge put the right people in the jury box and swore them in, and then appellant made his Batson objection. And his Batson objection needed to come before the jury was sworn in, and so his complaint was forfeited at trial. On the specific merits of the Batson complaint, first of all, we don't believe that veneer person 34 had the same characteristic that was the basis for the strike that the other 5 veneer persons had, that she was struck because she had been married to someone who'd been in and out of prison for years and years. And that's not, and there's nobody who said anything quite like that. I mean, some of them had talked about, I mean, they all had, that they had had some kind of unpleasant experience with the law where their family had, but nobody said that. And so there isn't a basis for a disparate treatment argument to begin with. But even if a panel could get past that and you could just lump this all into some generic claim that they had all had some kind of unpleasant experience with police, the other 5 veneer persons all had reasons to not strike them. And that's discussed in our brief at pages 17 through 19. And those positive characteristics of the other veneer persons, especially in light of the highly deferential standard of review, amply support the trial court's rejection of the Batson complaint. Finally, on point of error 3, the claim that he should have gotten a multiple assailants instruction, we've listed any number of reasons why, and I would like to talk about some of them. I think his first initial problem is that he shouldn't have gotten any self-defense instruction. He has got no business complaining that he should have gotten an even bigger self-defense instruction because he used deadly force. There's no evidence that he didn't use deadly force. So in order for him to get any self-defense instruction, he had to show that the victim, Mr. Toledo, attempted to use deadly force against him, and there's just absolutely no evidence of it. I don't even think that if appellant had just punched Mr. Toledo and this had been a simple assault case that he would have a self-defense claim because he provoked the difficulty. He went up and started the problem with Mr. Toledo. So appellant's arguments about self-defense, we think, just collapse at their inception. We also have made a long argument that we don't think that this multiple assailants instruction should ever be given in light of Giesberg. I'd point out that the Walters decision that we also cite in our brief is a lot less clear about the law than Giesberg. Giesberg seems to say that if it's not in the penal code, that you don't get it. And Walters seems to hedge on that. Walters seems to say you don't get it if it's a new kind of defense. And they said, well, Giesberg is an alibi defense. There's nothing like that in the penal code. Walters says that you can get these sort of elaborations on defenses that are in the penal code, but you can only get them when they don't negate a element of the offense, or they don't simply negate an element of the offense, and they don't comment on the evidence. And we think that this instruction would comment on the evidence because it's basically asking the judge to sort of wink at the jury and say, oh, you might give special consideration to the fact that there were multiple assailants, and we think that's a comment on the evidence. We also think that it's not really related to an offense in the penal code. It's a whole new defense because, you know, if we had a common law defense that said that if someone insults you, you can kill the governor, we wouldn't say that relates to self-defense. And what we have in this common law multiple assailants claim is that if A attacks you, you can attack B. And that's just, I don't believe that relates to self-defense as it's in the penal code. Even if the court were to reject that and we're going to find that the problem of his using deadly force didn't prohibit his claim, he still wouldn't have raised even this common law multiple assailants theory because, you know, this court's decision in Jones, which we discuss on pages 36 and 37 of our brief, talked about a kind of similar situation where Jones attacked, or he had a self-defense claim against Good Samaritan walked up, it was B, and he shot B, and this court said, well, that's not multiple assailants. You can't, just because you're involved in a alleged self-defense doesn't mean you can start blasting anybody that comes along. And even if you construed the facts in the light most favorable to appellant, that's all we have here. And that would even be factoring out the evidence that the police officer identified himself. You know, our case is much stronger than Jones because there's no evidence appellant didn't know that these people were police officers. He didn't testify. He didn't say he didn't think they were police officers. The three principal witnesses, Mr. Toledo, Officer Hull, Officer Miller, all said that the police identified themselves. There isn't any evidence that appellant had any doubt that they weren't police officers. And in fact, I'd point out that in order to, if the jury thought that appellant didn't know these were police officers, they would have acquitted him before they ever got to the self-defense issue because in the aggravated assault of a police officer, they were required to find that he knew that he was attacking a police officer. And the final thing I'd like to point out with regard to this multiple assailants thing is that on the issue of harmless error, he effectively did get a multiple assailants instruction because he was given a self-defense instruction with regard to Officer Miller, and he was given a self-defense instruction with regard to Mr. Toledo. And the jury rejected both of those. So there's just no doubt that the jury didn't think that he was being attacked by either Officer Miller or Mr. Toledo. And he's got no basis to claim that he was harmed. And unless there are any questions, we would pray that the trial court's judgment be affirmed.
Mr. Carroll, may I ask you a question about page 8 of your brief, line 9?
Okay, yes, sir.
Wherein someone, I presume you are the drafter of this, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
It says, if the court is inclined to make appellant's argument for him.
Yes, sir.
How does that help your case?
Well, I believe that the appellants should be required to make their arguments under.
I understand, but when you say if the court is inclined to make the arguments for the appellant.
Well, I would urge. I'm just saying that I urge the court to find that his complaint is not properly briefed and that it should be waived.
Did Mr. Curry have an opportunity to review your brief before it came to the court?
No, he doesn't review my briefs.
He doesn't. I think that you sort of have a fiduciary relationship to the district attorney not to make such comments like that, because personally, I've been around this courthouse for 30 years now. And I don't know a judge on this court that would be inclined to make an argument for either party.
Well, I apologize if you were offended. All I was trying to say is that we don't believe that he's properly briefed it, and in order to reach the merits, the court would have to make his argument.
I think it's very inappropriate to make a comment such as that. It almost is tantamount to suggesting to the court that we would violate a code of judicial conduct by making an argument for either party. So those, I consider them to be strong words, Mr. Carroll.
Well,
if it happens in the future, I would recommend strong sanctions, too. So.
Well, thank you. I'll keep that in mind. I didn't mean to be offensive.
I hope you will, Mr. Carroll. It's very significant.
I've seen lots of appellate decisions that say we will not make appellant's argument for him, and I didn't realize that the court would find that offensive. I apologize.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Curl. Mr. Couch, rebuttal?
I think the multiple assailant issue again, even though the state believes that the original self-defense issue shouldn't have been given to the jury at all, I think the fact that it was given to the jury by the judge requires the judge to do a complete issue that covers all the assailants. So I think if he even concede the point that it shouldn't have been done in the first place, the fact is it was done, but it should have been right. And we believe that because it was halfway done, it wasn't done correctly, and it harmed the appellant. The other thing I wanted to just touch on briefly is on the Batson issue. In reading the Moore case goes into great detail about why the jurors that were not struck either expressed bias or didn't express bias. That's the type of examination that should have occurred in the trial court. And I don't think Judge Thomas even responded to the allegation of the jurors, the 10, 11, 17, 39, 43. I think his summary was that this is a race-neutral jury, which doesn't really respond to the challenge. So I think in that regard, the response by the trial judge by the appellant's trial attorney pointing these specific problems out required the judge to respond to each one of them. He didn't do that. He just summarily said, I think this is a race-neutral jury, and I don't think that's adequate examination of the challenge. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Couch. Mr. Curl, your case is submitted. You all are excused, and we will adjourn court.